Back in 1 Samuel 9, verse 16, this is God talking to Samuel. It says, "About this time tomorrow, I will send you a man from the land of Benjamin, and you shall anoint him to be a prince over my people Israel. And he will deliver my people from the hand of the Philistines, for I have regarded my people because their cry has come to me." So we have that at the top of our lesson. I put that there because this is what we're getting into. We're getting into Saul's reign. We're going to see the battle with the Philistines over the next few chapters. But I also want to look at chapter 12, verse 14. Here, this is Samuel speaking to the people, and he says, verse 14, "If you will fear the Lord and serve him and listen to his voice and not rebel against the command of the Lord, then both you and also the king who reigns over you will follow the Lord your God. If you will not listen to the voice of the Lord, but rebel against the command of the Lord, then the hand of the Lord will be against you as it was against your fathers." So be obedient to me. You have a king who is now reigning over you, but you follow me and I will bless you. So though you have a king who reigns over you, I am still your authority. I am still your commander. This king reigns by my delegated authority. Now, as we move into chapter 13, it says in verse 1 that Saul was 30 years old when he began to reign, and he reigned for 42 years over Israel. Briefly, we're going to put a question mark by that. The Bible says it, but you can look over at Acts 13:21 and see that Paul says that Saul reigned 40 years. You can look at the different translations and see that the 30 and the 40 sometimes are omitted, that they sometimes they're reversed, where it says Saul was 40 when he began his reign and he was 30. It was 32 years over Israel. There is a kind of a question mark on the exact amount of time that he reigned. It says 42 here. That could tack on a couple of years of Ishbosheth, and that would overlap with David. Ishbosheth, and that would overlap with David. All to say is roughly 40 years. That's what we need to get out of that. That he reigned roughly 40 years. And if you got any more questions, I don't know, Bucket. Anyway, so as we move through these first five verses, we see that now Saul chose for himself some men, and then he put Jonathan over some men. And in verse three, it says, "Jonathan smote the garrison of the Philistines that was in Gibeah, and the Philistines heard of it." Verse four, all of Israel heard the news that Saul had smitten the garrison of the Philistines, and also that Israel had become odious to the Philistines. The people were then summoned to Saul at Gilgal. Now, as we get through this, you know, to me, this strikes me as kind of like poking the bear. Now, Saul has every right to attack the Philistines. He is going to be God's instrument to war against the Philistines. But what's interesting to me is, do you ever read that he inquired of the Lord? And this will be kind of a recurring thing as we get through Saul and into David and into Solomon. But here, it just says that Saul chose for himself some men, and then Jonathan smote the garrison. Did he inquire of the Lord? He's been put on this throne. He's been anointed by God, but he hasn't inquired of the Lord. And this becomes a problem, I would say, because when he poked that bear, we'll change the analogy to stepping on that anthill. Now you see just how massive of a force he's going to face. Now, generally, would that be a problem? Would it be a problem how many people Saul was going to face? Not if he's the Lord's anointed and he's following him. We'll see that in a second in somebody else's thinking. But this could be a problem if he doesn't inquire of the Lord what God will have him to do. The idea of following God's will, following God's commands versus doing what he wants to do. Moving down to verse 7. It says, "Also some of the Hebrews crossed the Jordan into the land of Gad and Gilead. But as for Saul, he was still in Gilead, and all the people followed him trembling." Now when the Philistines amass this army to come up against Israel, Saul's people split. They just split. There was 3,000 with them, and most of them took off. And so here you have, again, this idea that if Saul has inquired of the Lord, would he be concerned? Doesn't matter about the people, but would Saul be concerned? Verse 8, it says, "Now He waited 7 days according to the appointed time set by Samuel. But Samuel did not come to Gilgal, and the people were scattering from him. So Saul said, "Bring to me the burnt offering and the peace offering," and he offered the burnt offering. And as soon as he finished offering the burnt offering, behold, Samuel came, and Saul went out to meet him and to greet him. Now, is this a problem? Why is this a problem?
He didn't wait for Samuel.
What does it say over in 1 Samuel 10:8? We talked about this last class. I will come to you. Now, from the time of Abraham and the forefathers, to the time of the law being established, to the time of the judges and the time of Saul, has the Lord kept his word? And Samuel is a mouthpiece of the Lord. Is there any reason why Saul had any concern? Is there any reason why Saul should have had concerns that Samuel would not be there if he said he was going to be there? He's a prophet of God. Is there any reason why? No. But Saul took it upon himself. He said, "Bring me the burnt offering and the peace offering," and he offered the burnt offering. It says here that, but Samuel didn't come to Gilgal. So did he? He didn't come. I mean, is that a legitimate? He was supposed to be here. He's not here.
He came.
He didn't wait till the last hour, the last minute of the day. No, if he said he was going to come, he's going to come. This is a matter of faith and obedience to God's will. So what does Samuel say? He says, "What have you done?" And Saul, so let me ask this. I'm answering y'all's questions. I don't need to be doing that. How did Saul justify his actions?
Blaming the people.
Is that the only thing he did? Okay, so he blamed the people because they were scattering. He blamed the Philistines because they were amassing their army. Who else did he blame? Samuel. He got all kinds of excuses. "It's not my fault, Samuel. It's not mine. You didn't show up. It's not my fault, Samuel. The people were scattering. It's not my fault. Samuel, don't you see this force, this Philistines? They're amassing and you weren't here and the people are coming. I mean, so I had to do it. I had to. So I forced myself and offered the burnt offering." We've talked about this before. You know, self-control. That coconut cream pie after Thanksgiving, you know, when it was sitting in there, I had to force myself to eat it, right? Yeah, I don't see Samuel just sitting there struggling to do this. No, he chose. He made a choice. He was selfish. He made a choice to go ahead and make that offer, that offering, that sacrifice. He didn't have faith. All right, that's what this boils down to. So when I forced myself, Samuel, I forced myself to do this. What does Samuel tell him? He did. He said that's the consequences. But what did he tell him?
To obey is better than sacrifice. Because he said he did obey, but he really didn't.
He didn't. Well, we're going to get to some of how Saul's reasonings and everything. But no, what I'm getting at is he said you were foolish. You have acted foolishly. Here you are, the king. You are the anointed one. You have these prophecies that have come true. You've seen. You can read the law, the statutes, the ordinances. You've acted foolishly. It's Samuel. It's like a parent chastising a child because they've chosen to take something upon themselves. He says, "You have acted foolishly. You have not kept the commandment of the Lord your God." That's not the way Saul saw it, but that's what it is. He said, "You have not kept the commandment of the Lord your God, which he commanded you. For now the Lord would have established your kingdom over Israel forever. But now your kingdom shall not endure." That's the consequence. His kingdom would have endured, you know, through his lineage, but no. So, what does God say after that? It was Samuel, excuse me, through him being the mouthpiece.
Has sought a man after his own heart.
So what does that imply then?
He's going to be replaced.
Well, he said he's going to be replaced, but if he's seeking a man after his own heart, what does that imply about about Saul? He wasn't a man after God's own heart. He was selfish. He lacked faith. He was, in a way, he's exalting himself. Whether that was his true intention or not, I don't know. But it's exalting yourself above the Lord when you choose to do what you want to do versus what God has you to do. It was pleasing himself above God, doing what he thought was right versus doing what God told him to do. Did it matter the reasoning? No, it didn't matter the reasoning. You do what God told you to do, or you're not obeying the commandments of God. Is there application for that to us today? Definitely application for that, us today. I mean, do what God tells us to do, or else we're going to be acting foolishly. We can try to justify it all day long. And we're going to have to live with the consequences of our actions. We can ask for repentance. We can be penitent. But we would be acting foolishly if we don't abide by God's words.
Keith,
yes, sir.
If I understand it correctly, Wallace is a historian here, so he's correct. But in the 1800s, this is how instrumental music came into the churches. The singing wasn't good. I don't know if numbers were good then. And so they forced themselves to instrumental music to a family setting.
I want to make it sound better. We've only got 15 people here. We just want to make it sound better. We're all out of tune. We don't have anybody who's a musician here who can help us read notes. So you know what? We can't carry a tune, you know. So we're just going to get a piano in here. We can get a piano in here. Oh, we'll use the notes to help us guide it through. Or maybe we'll learn the songs. Next thing you know, it's more of a robust singing when we have. You can justify it all you want. It's not what God said to do, right? And so it's a trick. Now we need a band. That's right. Now we got to have a choir. We got a band to sing along with. Now we need a choir so they can sing for us. You can justify it all day long. You can see this over and over and over again, and how people have drifted further and further away from God. Selfish interests. Do as God has commanded you to do, or else you're acting foolishly. Questions, comments? It's not going to be the last time we harp on Saul and we get down on him. I tell you that. I don't know if you've ever studied, but man, the more I study this stuff, the more irritable I get. Like, I just, how thick-headed can somebody be? Anyway, all right. Back up in verse 5, I purposely skipped over this, but back up in verse 5, how many of the Philistines were there? Sands on the seashore, is that what you said? Okay, so it sands on the seashore. That's like I said, like an anthill. You just got ants everywhere. But what does it list? I mean, just the things of special note. Yeah, 30,000 chariots and 6,000 horsemen. All right. In verse 2 of this chapter, it said that Saul had 3,000 men. Now, again, if you inquire of God or you're doing God's will, 3,000 doesn't matter. He gets down to 600. All right? But when you don't do God's will, do you have a reason to be concerned? Yes. Like I said, he's poking the bear. Here you're going to go up against the Philistines, and we're going to know more and more about them. You know, we know the story of David and Goliath, but they're a warring nation. And now here's what you've done. You've taken upon yourself to go to war with these people, and you've got an itty-bitty army versus the army of the Philistines. It reminds me of Deuteronomy 7, where it talks about they were the fewest of all people. And then in that same chapter, verse 23, the Lord your God will deliver them before you. God's with you. You can survive. You can not survive. You will conquer, is the idea. But in Judges 3, 1 through 3, it talks about how. We'll flip over to Judges 3. We didn't really talk about this. Just a brief note. When talking about testing the people, Judges 3, in verse 22 of Judges 2, it says, in order to test them to test Israel by them, whether they were to keep the way of the Lord, to walk in it as their fathers did or not. So he left these nations to be a thorn in their side. So Judges 2:22, he's testing Israel to see whether they will keep the way of the Lord. But in Judges 3:1, now these are the nations which the Lord left to test Israel by them. That is, all who had not experienced any of the wars of Canaan, only in order that the generations of the sons of Israel might be taught war, those who had not experienced it formerly. These are the nations, and it lists them. So they were not only to be tested to see if they'll walk in God's way, but they'll be tested to essentially gain experience in war. So they're going to be fighting battles. But I also think of Deuteronomy chapter 8, the idea that they wandered in the wilderness. Why did the people wander in the wilderness? There's the judgment, and then there was the lesson. What's the judgment? Why did they wander in the wilderness?
Because
Lack of faith. Now, what is the lesson to be learned? He mentions it in Deuteronomy 8. To be humbled, for them to gain humility and dependence on the Lord. You're to be humbled, to be dependent upon the Lord. And then he goes on to say, I'm going to read that verse. Deuteronomy 8:16, it says, in the wilderness he fed you manna, which your fathers did not know, that he might humble you and that he might test you to do good for you in the end. But verse 17, it says, otherwise you may say in your heart, my power and the strength of my hand made me this wealth. The wandering in the wilderness was a judgment and it was a lesson to learn to be humble and dependent upon God. And he was concerned that this would happen here, that if they didn't pay attention and become humble, that my power, they would say in their hearts that my power, my strength of my hand has made this wealth. I've gotten this to this point. Yes, ma'am.
Mm-hmm. And in verse 2 it says, I'll give Midian into your hand unless you say by my own power. So God is doing it even with the 300.
Mm-hmm.
Instead of the big army that Midian had at his disposal.
Yeah, so again, Saul being thick-headed, what was going through his mind? If this isn't the will of the Lord, why in the world would you try to go do this? The roles could have been reversed. He could have had 30,000 chariots, 6,000 horses. Or horsemen, and then he could have had people like the sand, and 600 could have defeated him had God not been with him. But, I mean, why would you go up a force against a force like that without the Lord on your side? Just makes you wonder, right? So, get back over to 1 Samuel. So to add insult to injury, or to make this even more questionable, what were the weapons of choice for the Israelites?
Plow and shear.
Mattock.
Axe and hoe.
It says somewhere down there two forks, and I'm not as familiar with what a plow, shear, and mattock are, but maybe a pitchfork as well. This is now 3,000 strong, 600 strong, it don't matter. You're going up to fight another army, and this is what you have to fight with. Again, smart choice, not without the Lord on your side. Now, this isn't on the questions, but why don't they have these weapons? Why don't they have normal weapons? That's right. You know, they think about them judges. They constantly were going into and out of judgment of God and being taken or plundered from these other nations. And so in verse 19, it says, now no blacksmith could be found in all the land of Israel, for the Philistines said, otherwise the Hebrews will make swords and spears. They kept them all so that they couldn't have weapons to defend themselves. Now, again, had Saul inquired of the Lord, think about how much more glorified God would have been, whether it had been 3,000 or 600 Israelites going up against the armies of the sand of the Philistines with just plowshares and mattocks and axes and hoes. How much more would he have been glorified? How much more insane is it that he chose to do it without God? And he's going to use this type of weaponry. Thick-headed. Saul's thick-headed. All right, so we move into chapter 14. So we're building up to this exchange between the Philistines and Israel. And how would you summarize 1 Samuel 14, 6 through 10? It's Jonathan's faith. That's kind of the way I put this too. So Jonathan's faith in God. So here you are, you've got this small number against this insurmountable number. And here it says in 14:1, now the day came that Jonathan, the son of Saul, said to the young man who was carrying his armor, come, let us cross over to the Philistines' garrison that is on the other side. Go down to verse 6. So they come across into this little area, across some crags. And verse 6, it says, then Jonathan says to the young man who was carrying his armor, come and let us cross over to the garrison of these uncircumcised. Perhaps the Lord will work for us, for the Lord is not restrained to save by many or by few. The Lord is not restrained to save by many or by few. I'm putting my faith in the Lord because He can do anything. He will protect us. He will bless us. I have my faith in my Lord. He will, perhaps the Lord will work for us. And so he goes on to say, verse 7, his armor bearer said to him, do all that is in your heart, turn yourself, and here I am with you according to your desire. Then Jonathan said, behold, we will cross over the men and reveal ourselves to them. And if they say to us, wait until we come to you, then we will stand in our place and not go up to them. But if they say, come up to us, then we will go up, for the Lord has given them into our hands, and this shall be the sign of us. So here's the scenario. If we get there and they ask us to come closer, then I know the Lord is giving us giving them into our hands. If not, then we're just going to stay where we're at. Now, you're talking about, again, 30,000 chariots, 6,000 horsemen, all these men, people of the sand, or army of this, as numbered like the sand. And Jonathan's not scared. Me and my armor bearer are going to crawl over into this army. And if they tell us to come closer, God's going to give us to us. We got two against who knows how many. The faith of Jonathan. And so, as we think about Saul being thick-headed, here we get introduced to Jonathan, who seems to be, and will continue to build on this thought, a man of great faith, someone who puts his dependency on God. He has a love for God. He wants to do God's will. He has a trust in God and what he's doing.
It's interesting to see the difference in father and son.
It is.
And the son did not follow in the steps of his father in this case. Same thing with Timothy, for example.
It is.
Same thing with Josiah and Hezekiah.
With Jonathan, and I think this will be something we get into in the next two lessons. Jonathan's an interesting study. We'll look at that dynamic a little bit more, and we're going to look at the relationship of Jonathan and David and why that relationship was so close. But what caused Jonathan to have such a deep-rooted faith and Saul to have such a weak faith? Is Jonathan not of the same pedigree as Saul? He comes from men of valor. He comes from the tribe of Benjamin. He comes from the smallest of the families in the Benjamin. But yet Jonathan has this reliance upon God, this wholehearted faith in God. And had Saul not had Jonathan by his side as one of his commanders, how many times would you see a wrong turn be made? Jonathan here is an interesting study that he is obedient to his king. He is loyal to his king, not necessarily always obedient. And we'll see that in a second, but he is loyal to his king. He's loyal to his dad, but he puts God above his father and God's wishes above his father. Who did Jonathan attribute the battle or the victory to in verse 12? The Lord. Now, I don't know how you not attribute that to the Lord as you continue to read about this battle, but Jonathan knew before it really kind of took off. Verse 12, so the men of the garrison hailed Jonathan and his armor bearer and said, come up to us and we will tell you something. And Jonathan said to his armor bearer, come up after me, for the Lord has given them into the hands of Israel. Jonathan had no doubt that because these events had transpired the way they did, that the Lord was going to give them into his hand. And so you see that he climbs over and they fell before Jonathan. They put to death, I think, some 20 men and about a half a furrow of an acre. And I'm not exactly sure what that is, but it seems like it's not a very short span, kind of like going down an acre of land and they're plowing just in a short period of time. They failed 20 people. And here they go. Jonathan is not concerned. And there was trembling in the camp, in the field, and among all the people. Even the garrison, the raiders trembled, and the earth quaked so that it became a greater trembling. So here's God with him. God's with Jonathan as this goes through. And we see that, Saul tells them to bring the ark of God here. But while Saul's talking to the priest, the commotion in the camp of the Philistines continues to increase. And so Saul tells the priest, withdraw your hands. And then Saul said to all the people who were with him, and he rallied them, and they went and attacked. And then the battle was essentially over. They started pursuing the Philistines. In verse 23, it says, so the Lord delivered Israel that day, and the battle spread beyond Beth-Aven. So here you have this battle. The Lord has delivered them. Despite Saul's, foolish choices and his ignorance and his sin, God has delivered them. God is glorified in that. So though Saul was disobedient, Jonathan's faith allowed them to, it helped to glorify God because God delivered them through Jonathan. God's going to be glorified either way. But Saul doesn't have a problem messing things up again. So moving into verse 24, what order does Saul give in verse 24? Don't eat. Don't eat. Why? He wants to have time to avenge his enemies, right? What does it say? Somebody read verse 24. Says, cursed be the man who eats food before evening until I have avenged myself on my enemies. None of the people tasted food. This is God's victory. This is God who should be avenging himself. But no, what does Saul say? Again, this is the idea of him being thick, him being selfish, him being self-centered, him exalting himself before God. Cursed be the man who eats food before evening until I have avenged myself on my enemies. Is this a commandment from God? It is a commandment from a king, but it's not inspired by God. This is Saul arbitrarily putting the people under an oath. How'd that work out for him? Not good. I agree, not good. So what happens?
Jonathan eats.
Jonathan's just come back from slaying Philistines. He comes back in and verse 27, but Jonathan had not heard what his father, when his father had put the people under the oath. And so, therefore, he put out the end of the staff that was in his hand and dipped it in the honeycomb and put his hand in his mouth and his eyes brightened. Verse 28, then one of the people said, your father strictly put the people under oath, saying, cursed be the man who eats food today, and the people will weary. And so Jonathan goes on to make that point. Well, if we had been able to take care of the spoils or eat of this land, then, you know, how much greater of a slaughter would this be? Verse 30, how much more if only the people had eaten freely today of the spoil of their enemies, which they found? For now the slaughter among the Philistines has not been great. Because of this oath, what winds up happening with the Israelites?
They're sinning. They rushed on there and ate, and they ate the blood. And so, you know, the whole situation goes downward, and the people sin.
The people do sin, and they're responsible for their own actions, but Saul bears partial responsibility for this. I don't know, ignorant, selfish,
autocratic,
ill-advised decision to put him under an oath so he could avenge himself. Just how thick-headed is he? And then it gets worse. So going through, well, let's keep moving down. So Saul says in verse 33. Then they told Saul, saying, behold, the people are sinning against the Lord by eating with the blood. And he said, you have acted treacherously. Roll a great stone to me today. Verse 34 says, Saul said, disperse yourselves among the people and say to them, each one of you bring me his ox or his sheep and slaughter it here and eat. And do not sin against the Lord by eating with the blood. So all the people that night each brought one of his ox with him and slaughtered it there. Verse 35. And Saul built an altar to the Lord, and it was the first altar that he had built to the Lord. Then Saul said, let us go down after the Philistines by night and take spoil among them until the morning light. And they said, do whatever seems good to you. And so the priest said, let us draw near to God here. So Saul inquired of the Lord. Saul inquired of God, finally. So shall I go down after the Philistines? Will you give them into the hand of Israel? But he did not answer him on that day. So verse 38, Saul said, draw near here, all you chiefs of the people, and investigate to see how this sin has happened today. For as the Lord lives, this is verse 39, who delivers Israel, though it is in Jonathan my son, he shall surely die. Huh. Okay. I'm just, you know, as I'm reading this, I'm going, what are you talking about? So keep going. So, verse 40. Then he says to all Israel, you shall be on one side, and I and Jonathan, my son, will be on the other side. And the people said to Saul, do what seems good to you. Therefore, Saul said to the Lord, the God of Israel, give a perfect lot. And Jonathan and Saul had taken. Jonathan and Saul were taken, but the people escaped. Saul said, cast lots between me and Jonathan, my son. And Jonathan was taken. Then Saul said to Jonathan, tell me what you have done. So Jonathan told him and said, I indeed tasted of the little honey with the end of the staff that was in my hand. Here I am. I must die. Hold up. Question mark. Let's stop right here. Let's go back to verse 39. So this is Saul. We'll go to verse 38. Saul said, draw near here, all you chiefs of the people, and investigate and see how this sin has happened today. So what sin is he talking about? Jonathan eating. Now, which is, that's, is that a commandment from God? Now, it was a disobedience to his king's oath, but I mean, we've just got the Israelites out here, Saul being partially responsible, eating with the blood, and here Saul is about to kill Jonathan because of what? His oath wasn't followed? He's so concerned about putting Jonathan to death for the sin that he committed, and it sin question mark, but he's not concerned about the sin that he was responsible for, the people eating of the blood. And so, verse 39, for as the Lord lives, who delivers Israel, though it is in Jonathan my son. So here it is, you know, the Lord delivered Israel through my son Jonathan. He must surely die. I just saw so thick-headed. I mean, I don't know how else to put it. I mean, this is ridiculous to me. He's so self-absorbed. He's so worried about his own things and his oath not being followed. He doesn't see what's right in front of him and that he's partially responsible for what the Israelites have done. He is the leader of this nation. Put your faith and trust in God. Stop worrying about yourself. Stop putting yourself first. Stop worrying about avenging your people, your enemies on yourself. Stop going to war without talking to God. It's so convoluted, so thick. I keep just coming back to that word.
You've been making the point about Saul's lack of turning to God. I thought it was interesting that the historian who ever wrote 1 Samuel made a little note at verse 35. It was the first altar that he built to the Lord. I don't know how much time he spent tired from the time he was anointed.
Very true. So, I mean, we're not reading some secular stuff. I mean, we're probably not 2 years into Saul's reign, but we're 2 years into Saul's reign. I mean, he's already fought a battle. He's already leading a nation. I mean, and so I have on here, what do you notice about Saul? What do you notice about the order and the events thereafter in these verses? And, you know, so 24, 35, 30, 35 through 37, 39 and 40, they're selfish and self-centered. And that's one of them. That's one of the verses, verse 35, that Saul built an altar to the Lord. It was the first altar he had built. Just now, after you went to war without inquiring of God, after Jonathan was the one who God prevailed through Jonathan, then all of a sudden you decide that you're going to avenge your enemies, and then now it's a good time after you've caused some of this to happen that now you're going to build your first altar. Just, it's baffling. Again, Saul's weak faith and his selfishness and being self-centered. Ultimately, in verse 45, it says, but the people said to Saul, must Jonathan die, who has brought about the great deliverance in Israel? Far from it. As the Lord lives, not one hair of his head shall fall to the ground, for he has worked with God this day. So the people rescued Jonathan, and he did not die. Can you think about, for a second, put yourself in the shoes of one of the people of the nation, one of the Israelites? Here you've got a king who is acting foolishly. Here you've got a king who was not the one who prevailed, but it was through Jonathan that they prevailed. And now he's wanting to put this man, his son, to death, when obviously it was Jonathan prevailing because God worked with him that day. Can you imagine what state of the country would be in, the state of the nation would be in, if Jonathan weren't there? I'd be fearful, because at least Jonathan does have some sway over his father. At least he has some say. He's over some people. You know, having someone next to you that does have a great faith, or in the case of the Israelites, having someone in a higher position of power who does have faith may inspire you a little bit more than someone who is not acting the way they should. They're acting deranged or hysterical. So, but the people stood up for him. And so the people rescued Jonathan, and he did not die. And in verse 46, then Saul went up from pursuing the Philistines, and the Philistines went to their own place. Verse 47 through 52 just talks about the continued warfare that Saul was involved in. It does say in verse 48, he acted valiantly and defeated the Amalekites and delivered Israel from the hands of those who plundered them. And so we learn a little bit more about Saul and his wives and some of his commanders as we move into chapter 15. Now I'm going to put a pin in that for a second and say we're 5 minutes from ending class. I know that. I had no intention of getting through all this material today. So where we get to today, but we'll pick up on 15. I mean, we'll pick up on lesson 5 and go into lesson 6 next week. But I felt like it's important to see Saul and the choices he's making as we continue to move through. All right, 15:1, it says, then Samuel said to Saul, the Lord has sent me to anoint you as king over his people, over Israel. Now, therefore, listen to the words of the Lord. Thus says the Lord of hosts, I will punish Amalek for what he did to Israel, how he set himself against him on the way while he was coming up from Egypt. Now, go and strike Amalek and utterly destroy all that he has and all that he has, and do not spare him, but put to death both man and woman, child and infant, ox and sheep, camel and donkey. So what is Saul to do? And why? He's supposed to strike the Amalekites. How is he supposed to do it? What does he tell them to do?
Utterly destroy them.
I mean, but isn't that heartless? I mean, he's talking about putting to death not just men and women, but he's talking about children and infants. He's talking about how grotesque is it to go and just kill all the animals too. Why? Why are they doing that?
It is the land of the idolatry
that they represent. Is it the idolatry that they represent? That's not what I read. In verse 2 it says, I will punish them because of what they did to Israel when he set himself against him on the way while he was coming out of Egypt. It's a judgment of Amalek. His people are going to be destroyed because they attacked the Israelites when they were coming out of Egypt. So here God's telling them, I'm judging them. He says back then, I want to see where I've got it here in my notes. Exodus, go over to Exodus 17. Well, that's a secondary of this, but I mean, it's because they do need to clear it. But and this plays straight into the mindset of what Samuel's gonna of Saul and Samuel as we move through this chapter. You know, yes, they're to conquer the land. They're supposed to remove those in the land and the idolatry. But this was a specific judgment of a people. Chapter Exodus 17, verse 14, it says, then the Lord said to Moses, write this in a book as a memorial and recite this to Joshua. Let me back up for a second. Exodus 17, 8. Then Amalek came and fought against Israel at Rephidim. So Moses said to Joshua, choose men for us and go out and fight against Amalek. Tomorrow I will station myself on top of the hill with the staff of God in my hand. And this is the battle where as Moses is there, if his hands are up, they're prevailing. And if his hands fall down, they're losing. Eventually they set him on a stone. They hold up his hands and they prevail. But Amalek should have never attacked Israel. And so verse 14, then the Lord said to Moses, write this in a book as a memorial and recite it to Joshua that I will utterly blot out the memory of Amalek from under heaven. Moses built an altar and named it the Lord, my banner. And he said, the Lord has sworn the Lord will have war against Amalek from generation to generation. So when we get over to Saul in chapter 15, this is a judgment. This is a judgment from God. Go judge my people. Go destroy them for what they did. Utterly destroy them. Get rid of their men and their women and their children. You don't mess with my nation. They should have never dealt with y'all the way they did when y'all came out of Egypt. So this is a direct judgment from God. Listen to my words is what Samuel says to Saul. This is from the Lord.
Couldn't this also be assessed just to see
I mean, it turns out it can be a test. I mean, God wants them judged. Whether Samuel does, or whether Saul does it or not, it can be a test of whether he does or doesn't. I mean, I know that they are getting tested, but you know, it says here that at some point in time, the Lord will have a war against Amalek. The Lord, I will utterly blot them out. So he has his will that he wants done, and it can be a test from the standpoint of, are they going to do it? But this is what he wants done. They free will, they can do what they want, and we see that that's what happens. But God is telling Saul, his instrument, to go and utterly destroy them. He's judging the nation, and if they've been paying attention to the statutes and ordinances, and they know this, he told Joshua to write it down. You know, you see that this is a judgment of those of Amalek themselves, and so.
I agree with that. To me, I also see it as twofold. I am telling you what to do.
Are you going to do it? Okay, I see. Yeah, I mean, it can be a test. I mean, you got an F for that one. And we'll get into that. We're gonna stop there because we're right at time. I don't want to get into any further. But look over this passage. We're gonna look at what God tells them, and then we're gonna look at what Saul did. And then again, justification. How do you justify your actions? And so we'll stop there, and we'll pick back up on Wednesday night, and then we'll move into chapter six, lesson six, starting Wednesday, and hopefully we finish it. You know, I'm a fallen. Footsteps of the teachers before me, and we're going to get behind maybe, but anyway. Class, don't forget class material in the back. 6, 7, and 8 are in the back. So thank you for your attention this morning.